Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop on WAMC. Our live afternoon call-in talk show is here. I'm Ray Graff. Today we convene the Science Forum, and we have gathered some wonderful, brilliant people to answer your questions and comments. Don't look dubious.
Stop
you really are
now.
Brilliant and wonderful. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You can comment on our website, WAMC.org/Vox Pop. There is a spot where you can comment beneath today's program. But do call, if you would, 1-800-348-2551. Science Forum, always a fun show. Best to get in early before the topics sort of become monolithic. Usually a couple of calls early about one topic, and the whole show is all about that topic. And let's welcome our scientists from my left to my right.
I'm Nancy Slack. I'm an ecologist and a birder. Snowy owls are back, I hear, from Russell Sage College.
Nancy, nice to have you here. And
Ed Stander, SUNY Copleskill, geology, astronomy, environmental science, and whatever else strikes my fancy.
Music.
Oh, for sure.
Okay. Well, nice to have you here as well. The number to call, once again, 1-800-348-2551. And Ed, my memory not very good. You said there was some homework after a recent program. You'll have to refresh my memory.
Oh, let's see. We had a question about bears. It was getting cold out.
Oh, yeah.
Which is surprising because it's not cold anymore. And the question was, if it gets really cold out, where the bears hibernate earlier? Because apparently the bear was attacking her dog or something of that.
Oh, that's correct. Yeah.
And the answer is that it makes no difference how cold it is. The bears will do what the bears do.
So just it's on a sort of a moon cycle
basis.
Or something?
Yeah,
or
it's
sunlight-based?
Sunlight-based, and the bears do what they want.
But they won't come out of hibernation once they get into hibernation, will they?
That's right.
Okay. Otherwise, it would just be a nap. once again, number to call, 1-800-348-2551. And Nancy, you said you've been sort of reading up on Ebola, or you can at least recommend a few books for those who are confused with all the misinformation that's out there.
Let me do that now?
Sure.
Well, there's a sort of updated book by one of my favorite science writers. His name is David Quammen, which is just called Ebola. So if you want to read a short but to-the-point book about what's going on now and has been going on before, that's a good one. But there's also a somewhat older book, which is called Virus Ground Zero. And that one is a really good book for people who are not really scientists. It explains extremely well about viruses, what they are, how they work, about epidemiology, about why it's not likely that an Ebola epidemic is going to go, or pandemic is going to go around the world as fast as a flu epidemic, for example.
And why would that primary reason be?
Because it's not transmitted by an aerial transmission, you know, by coughing in your face over there. It needs to be some kind of fluids that you're connected with, which means that it's not as hard to get as HIV, but it's more.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I'll raise my hand because I feel like
he's raising his hand
I'm
now.
With teachers. But isn't there a significant amount of fluid involved with a good quality cough?
Well, there's much discussion about that. It is possible if I'm a health worker right next to you and you're coughing up fluid in my face, yes, that's possible. But if you're sitting on an airplane, that's extremely unlikely.
That's unusual, so because I just recently saw a YouTube video where they showed how the liquids from a cough travel through the entire cabin of an airplane, and everybody winds up getting a little bit of it. How much of it do you actually have to get to have an effect?
I think more than, you know, maybe if the person sitting next to you, like you and me here, coughs up at you, he's getting away
from me
now. You
want to demonstrate? Go ahead, Nancy.
That has not happened. I mean, there have been a number of people on airplanes where there has been someone that was getting Ebola. So I think it's not the same as a new flu virus, which we haven't got anything to work for. But it's on the other hand, it's extremely difficult once it gets to a city in a place that has very little infrastructure or very good medical facilities, which we all need to, not you and me perhaps, but various countries that have more ability to pay need to help with. Doctors Without Borders got there right away, but they didn't have enough funding to really stop the epidemic. At any rate.
Is this getting to a point where it will continue not infinitely, but for a long, long time? Or can it be eradicated to some extent?
I think it will probably be eradicated at some point, but probably not till sometime, maybe the end of next year. But
Really? That soon?
That's just, different people are making different predictions, but not next month. In some places now, there's still more people, more new cases than people are containing them. It's not such a danger for those of us who live in the United States or Spain or other countries with good medical care. But anybody can get on a plane and take it somewhere. I mean, that has happened and it can happen again. But it's not something that you and I have to be afraid of. But I think we do have to be very concerned about all the people who are very ill and dying in Africa.
And I understand the flu vaccine out this year, not all that effective.
No, I know someone who got the flu, who had the flu vaccine, and they told her that the particular kind of flu she had was not one they were counting on. That's always a guess. It's a good guess, but it's never completely sure that it will be the right kinds of flu.
How do they make that guess?
It starts out in the East, and I believe in China, and people get the flu early on. They check the kinds of flu that those people get, and then they try to make a vaccine. And actually, I'm not an expert on that particular subject.
No.
Maybe somebody else would like to
call. I'm sure Ed is. No. All right. Well, let's go to the phones then. Let's go to Merle in Argyle. Merle, you're on.
I've just got a simple question about a bucket of water and ice. Why ice forms at the top of the bucket, and then I got a little follow-up.
All right.
And you've got an ice expert here.
Yes, he said so before the show, believe it or not.
I'm an ice guy, yes. it's very, very simple. In a bucket, you have to lose heat to make ice. And the free surface at the top is the easiest place to do that because, first of all, as ice begins to form, or as the water cools, especially towards the top, you start getting nucleation sites at that place. In order to make ice, you have to have a nucleation site. You have to have little ice crystals that form. And they often form on the side of the bucket and then fall in. And so those become the places where ice begins to nucleate. And once it starts to form, if the water's already cold, it goes very, very fast. That's the main reason for it. Also, if you have a metal bucket, you may have it cool on all sides, but generally speaking, you have a lot of convection in the water, and it's at the top surface where it's relatively quiet that things first will form because the water's not mixing up cold and hot.
Uh-huh.
How's that?
It freezes.
What if you break the ice? Now, does it form up faster, or would it be better to take the ice out and have it all start the whole process over again?
Well, if
I'm feeding animals, so I'm trying to keep water out for them, but I say, well, I guess I'll break the ice and throw the ice out and let it freeze again.
Okay, if you break the ice, then all those ice crystals that are in there become nucleation for new ice, and so it'll freeze faster. If you take the ice block out, it'll take a lot longer to freeze.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Merle.
I have a question here. But often there's ice on the surface or down a certain distance, but underneath that, where there are fish for ice fishing and sometimes things like turtles or muskrats swimming around. Why is that?
Why there's ice at the bottom?
Why is it not ice why is there water below? It just doesn't freeze.
Oh, well, because water is at its densest at 4 degrees. Celsius, or 36 degrees. And the water at the top, which is going to be colder than that, is less dense. So that you get water at the top, which is less dense, and that therefore that stuff is the one that freezes first. Below that, the water will tend to convect, because as it gets to that 4 degree temperature, it'll start to drop, and that'll move water back up towards the top.
Uh-huh.
So it's only at the top layer that you get development of good crystals, if it's quiet water. If it's not quiet water and you get mixing, then you get these little crystals forming, and they're called frazzle, and that's a whole other story.
Oh, yeah.
In rivers, you get it forming.
But it's fascinating
everywhere.
To go at Fisher's Ferry, for example, to go ice skating and suddenly see a tortoise turtle moving underneath you, or a muskrat, or a great big fish, staying there all winter.
Yeah. Let's go quickly to Mike in Great Barrington. Mike, you're on.
Yes. Good afternoon, guys. This is Mike. I just had a quick question. I was wondering if you guys know anything about helium-3 fusion reactors. And the last thing I heard about it was It's PPPL in Princeton. Was supposed to have an operational reactor powered up over the summer of 2014. But I haven't done any research or read anything lately on anything.
Yeah, I've heard nothing about it. And to tell you the truth, I don't know a great deal about it. That's more in the physics range. And the reason I'm a geologist is because I never did well in physics.
They have a lot of helium-3 on the moon, I understand.
Yes, they do. Yes.
Yeah.
I have a physicist husband, but I don't think he's listening. And Ken Wells has a bad back, so he's not with us today.
Oh, is that why he's not here? All right, yeah. Well, we will give him a pass. Mike, thanks, and sorry we couldn't give you more information.
Call again to the next one, and someone will be here.
Fair enough. A number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Mr. Zach, the engineer, let's take a break, and we'll be back.
Support for WAMC comes from Snow Farm, Williamsburg, Massachusetts, a New England craft program offering weekend and week-long workshops for adults and teens in a farm setting. Registration now open for 2015 classes, snowfarm.org. And Rhinebeck Artist Shop, professional picture framing and fine art materials, art sets and stocking stuffers, Rhinebeck, New Paltz, and 793 Broadway in Kingston, rhinebeckart.com.
Well, welcome back to the show. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Nancy Slack is here and Ed Stander is here, and you are there on your telephone. It's the Science Forum. Over we go to Ellen in the Catskills. Hi, Ellen, you're on.
Hi. Thank you very much for putting me on. Excuse my voice, please. It's a voice disorder.
I'm sorry.
Can you hear me?
Sure.
Okay, great. I live in the Catskills in Grahamsville. That's in Sullivan County, the county that will hopefully be getting a casino today. And I was wondering, I watch these great mining shows of people doing that, mining and finding the gems. And I was just wondering what's in the ground around here if I started to become a rat hound, and what temperature has to do with it, because I know that gems change color with different temperatures, and if that makes a difference that I live here versus where they're finding all those neat gems.
Okay, so gems in the Catskills, what can we find there if we dig? Oh, well, let's turn his mic on, Zach.
Yeah, might as well.
That's a good idea. He sounds even better now.
No, believe me, I don't.
Marginally.
Yes. Gems in the Catskills. Apart from quartz crystals, there aren't a lot of gems in the Catskills, because gems usually form from igneous rocks, and the Catskills are almost all sedimentary rocks. They're part of an old delta, and as a result, there isn't a lot there to be looking for, unfortunately.
Hmm.
They have found diamonds in the Catskills, but they were diamonds that got washed down from Canada.
Mm.
You could tell that because they say made in Canada on the bottom.
How about glacial drift?
That's associated with it. Stuff from the stuff from the north can make it down south, but not a lot, because the Catskills themselves, they were there way before the glaciation, and therefore the only stuff that you may find is some of the stuff, glacial stuff on the top of the mountains.
Okay.
But very, very little. As far as temperature goes, yes, temperature has an effect, but not in sedimentary rocks, only in igneous rocks.
Okay.
There are actually gems in various kinds in the Adirondacks, though. Yeah. I'm actually wearing a necklace with something called labradorite on it, kind of feldspar, which some of our highest mountains have a great deal of. It's a very resistant kind of mineral.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there are garnets and fool's gold.
Yep.
Pyrite.
Right.
Other things to look for if you're in the Adirondacks.
Right, and those things may have been washed down into the Catskills by the glaciers, but that's about it. Otherwise,
okay,
there would be nothing there.
So nothing there, Ellen.
Sorry.
Thank you for the call. We appreciate it very much. So the Adirondacks are igneous?
Adirondacks are
And they're
igneous.
Growing, right?
And they're rising.
They're
rising.
I thought they were among the faster rising mountains.
Well, that's due
but
just
much,
to erosion.
Much of it is metamorphic rock as well.
Okay, over to David in New Paltz. David.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for doing a good job. Happy holiday.
And same to you.
This is a story for Nancy. It's a bird story.
All right.
A couple of weeks ago when there was snow on the ground, I was walking in my backyard. I have a white parka, and I was wearing a hat that's like concentric circles. It's like a green, yellow, red, and black, and about quarter-inch circles. And they... It looked like a target of some sort. It was from Guatemala, you know? And I was walking from behind a Norwegian spruce that I have that's about going on 50 feet high.
Uh-huh.
And I saw a hawk coming by. And it must have been about 70 feet high or so,
Wow. Pretty
close to the ground. And I was just watching it. And I said, boy, that's interesting. And it just stopped in midair, dropped like a rock, hit me in the head.
Oh, you're kidding.
And took my hat. And it was a scary experience, you know. And it was like enough force to drive me to my knees, you know.
Wow.
And it hit me in the ears with its wings, you know.
Does it seem like a very large hawk or smaller?
Oh, it's good size. I mean, I'd say it was
about five pounds. They must have thought you were a cardinal, not a goldfinch, because they're not yellow in the winter. Some kind of bird, because they do drop right down to my feeder, Cooper's hawks especially, and try to pick up birds off the feeder. I never heard of one doing that, but a lot of kinds of hawks do attack people near nests. Now, there's not going to be a nest anywhere near here. Thatcher Park, sometimes they have to close some of the trails because goshawks actually come down and do that to invading humans.
Wow.
But your hat might have had something to do with it, because birds have the same kind of color vision that we do, very close, and can tell different colors. And they must maybe this hawk was confused as what sort of bird it could be. But I don't know. I have seen smaller birds land on people's hats, but I never saw a hawk do that.
And it took it to the top of the tree there, you know,
uh-huh.
and pecked at it a bit and flew away.
And left
but
it there.
I was amazed how quickly it could glide, say, about 20 miles an hour, come to a dead stop, and drop like a rock.
Yeah, well, that's hawk behavior. That's not so strange. But the fact that it would have come down to attack your hat does seem odd.
Are there any nearsighted hawks?
I wonder. That's a good question.
Although I imagine they wouldn't last long if they were.
No.
Well, I figure, you know, I had a white parka on, you know?
Yeah.
And I was walking on the snow. So it may have just saw the hat about, you know, 5'6", 5'8" from the ground floating by, you know?
Yeah.
Anyways, that's my story. It never happened to me before.
Well, that's a great story.
I might see some bird people tomorrow, and I will relate your story and see if I can find anything more.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. I can't believe you haven't called Rich Guthrie and shared that one.
I did call, but you kept me on hold.
Oh,
my bad. Hey, David, thanks a lot for the call.
That's what's good about the Science Forum. There's always room.
Well, we have we have one open line at the present time. Carol in East Hampton, Mass. Carol.
Hi. I have an interesting bear story. just after Halloween, we had two large pumpkins, probably each weighing at least 10, 15 pounds a piece, not carved. So they were completely full, and they were sitting on a deck that was about 4 feet above ground. I come out in the morning, and I see the pumpkin out in the side yard, and the side yard is a route that the bears are known to take kind of to come through our land. And the pumpkin was sitting there. I went out and looked at it, and it was all kind of chewed up, scraped up, and a bear scat quite next to it. Now, looking at where he would have taken it from, I would have thought he would have dropped it, would have smashed, and there would have been evidence of that.
Yeah.
There wasn't. Would it be possible for a bear to pick up this large pumpkin and get it over to the side yard and start working on it?
I don't think the bear could have picked it up, but the bear likely could have pushed it, because people, you know, you have to have a bear canister now in the Adirondacks that put your food in. Well, I have a story about a young couple from Canada who came to camp in the Adirondacks, and they had a canister. A bear came and pushed their canister all around the campsite, trying very hard to open it a long way, and finally sat down next to it for the night. This young couple came in finding some shelter because they didn't want to spend the night with the bear. So they can move large objects, but I doubt there's any way a bear could pick it up. What do you think?
Well, that's what we were trying to figure out, because it would have probably, you know, was getting a little bit soft, smashed somehow if he rolled it off. He had to roll it off and drop to the ground, which was about a 4 foot drop. So
my guess is that the bear probably rolled it on itself, which
uh-huh.
keeps it from breaking. I worked up north for a number of years on Baffin Island, and I have seen bears use any number of things as basketballs, including very expensive data loggers.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They just, anything that's out of the ordinary, they absolutely love.
Yeah.
And so my guess is that's probably what happened. I was actually in southern Newfoundland at one point and had a big bear help a little bear up into a window to get into a cabin to eat all my granola. So they'll do pretty well anything. They're very, very smart.
They are very smart.
We had one in our yard in Glenville a couple of years ago that actually turned over the garbage can and took a whole bag of a white bag of garbage all the way to our backyard. So, I mean, and they carry big fish, too. So, you know, they can carry things.
Yeah.
Also, they're quite clever. There's even a couple of them that have figured out how to open these food canisters. And uh-huh. That's a problem. They have to move those bears out. Most of them have not.
Great call, Carol.
All right, thanks.
Thank you very much. 1-800-348-2551. Nancy in Belchertown. Nancy, you're on.
Hi, thanks. I live a couple miles away from the Quabbin here in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. and a very knowledgeable friend of mine saw a mountain lion that had been struck by a car in the Quabbin, and the rangers came, took it away, and grilled her pretty aggressively about, did you take a picture of it? It's not what you think. Go away.
Really?
And they whisked, oh, yeah.
Oh,
this
yeah.
is a friend
it's like
of
a UFO sighting. The men in black come and say you did not, it was a weather balloon?
Now, wait a minute. Did they, the actual mountain lion was there?
It had been hit by a car, which I understand happens quite a bit. And it was dead. And the person who called her was her friend who had driven the car. And the car was disabled, so she called and said, will you come get me? I've hit a something in the Quabbin. And when my friend got there to pick up her other friend, the rangers were quite adamant about, this is not what you think, and don't talk about it.
Really?
Like, you know what you're talking about, and did you take any pictures with your cell phone? And she was puzzled, and neighbors have reportedly seen them in different parts of Belchertown. But I read a book called Cougar, and from what I'm taking away is that the idea of mountain lions or cougars being reintroduced to Massachusetts naturally is a political, environmental football. You'll read about some states down south, nope, we don't have any. I don't care what you saw. I don't care, anything. And other places are more open to it, and it seems to me,
You know what?
I don't know.
This has been going on for quite a long time, that people have cited mountain lions under many different names in the Adirondacks, for example, even in Glenville, they say. Now there's so many people with smartphones that somebody is going to get a photograph of a real mountain lion with a long tail. I mean, mm-hmm. there's nothing else that looks like a mountain lion that's not in a zoo. So eventually we're going to find out the answer to this. I think they are officially in Vermont, and I'm not going to swear to that, but I do know someone who did see one and described it to me, and it seemed there was nothing else it could be, but up on a mountain. But nobody has actually photographed one or found a dead one that by this,
right.
that they photographed. So anybody who sees something they think is not a bobcat or anything else, but a mountain lion with a long tail, please get your cell phone out and take a picture.
Right.
And don't tell anyone.
No, they'll come and get you.
My bottom question is, if they're denying that they're here, is it to protect the mountain lions, or is it to keep some of us from getting all hysterical and starting to carry guns and
I think it might be both, actually, because there are mountain lions in California right up close to where people hike, and they are a problem. Mm. And I think that people don't want false reports of mountain lions for sure. But if they find real evidence, put it in the newspaper. Take your cell phone and take it to the newspaper. Then they'll have to admit they're there and do something.
How big is a mountain lion?
I don't know about the people in Massachusetts, but I don't think the DEC would do that in New York.
Well, the DEC says there are no mountain lions in New York.
That's right.
No, and there are no mountain lions that actually have been certified. Well, there were formerly in the Adirondacks. You can see one in the State Museum that was killed. But no, there has not been an authenticated report of a mountain lion. It doesn't mean they can't come in from somewhere else. What about all these moose we have?
Yeah.
Oh, they were introduced.
So thank you very much for the call. So how big is a mountain lion? I've not seen one.
How big is a mountain lion? That's a good question. Bigger than a bobcat.
How big is a bobcat?
I want to show you. A bobcat is bigger than any
red box.
Any big domestic cat, but there are some domestic cats that are almost as big as bobcats.
Okay.
Short cat.
So a mountain lion is significantly bigger than that.
And has a long furry tail. So, I mean, it's not likely to be mistaken for a bobcat if you get a good look at it. We do have bobcats in New York.
Yeah, well, you know, Ward Stone was on, and I believe someone else had mentioned thought they saw a mountain lion.
Many people have thought they saw a mountain lion.
I guess many people think they see Bigfoot. And maybe there is a Bigfoot, but how long can you be in an area and not be seen before?
Well, DEC says there are no Bigfoot in New York's
New York State.
All right, fair enough. And they're also bigger than a bobcat. So let's go to David in Olive Bridge. David. Hello, David.
Yes, hi.
You're on.
Hi. Yeah, I called a couple weeks ago, but two quick questions. One is chemistry physics question. The other one is about blue jays.
All right.
Okay. Blue jays, they're not right now, but previously taking acorns and picking them off the tree.
Okay.
Well, their relatives do that and stick them into cracks in trees and keep them for the winter, so I wouldn't be surprised to see that.
Oh, so they actually will eat them?
I think they probably acorns. Shells are somewhat cracked by that time. I see no reason why they couldn't eat them.
Oh, okay. I had no idea because I was sitting on our sun porch and I have a white oak and it almost hit me in the head a couple times and I looked up and it was not squirrels, nothing. It was blue jays.
Wow.
And I actually watched them pick them off.
They eat
and drop them.
They eat huge amounts of suet off my suet feeders.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
I've never seen one.
Quick.
I don't ever wear a hat.
No, it's the first for me.
Oh, yeah, they swoop down on hats, too, if you heard the first part of this program.
That's crazy.
I once left my bicycle. When I was a little girl, I left my bicycle under a big tree, and the blue jay made its nest in that tree, and I couldn't retrieve it. I think it was a tricycle until after the nest was out.
Oh, wow.
No kidding. Wow.
So you had a question about steam or some odd?
Yeah, steam. Boiling water. It's always bothered me. I've asked chemistry teachers, people with, trained in this field, everybody had different answers. You put an open pot, saucepan, whatever, boil water, and it comes to a boil, turn the flame off, and then you see steam vapor. Why don't you see it while it's boiling?
Anybody?
Ken, where are you?
I've always noticed it. It's just a weird phenomenon. I just didn't understand.
Well, there's one thing I would suggest. I'll do it at home, and I've been known to do stupid things like that. But basically, as long as it's boiling, there's a lot of movement of air above the water.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so if there is any steam, it gets mixed up with air that's coming in as that steam goes off, and so that
it will actually.
We'll both take it for homework and try boiling some water.
Yeah.
Just do it as a practice. Just put a plain water and bring it to a boil. When you shut it off, an immense amount of steam comes off, mm-hmm. a visible steam.
Right.
I'm just wondering maybe, I have no idea, and I asked a couple of people and they gave me different answers.
Would there be steam before it boiled?
Well, if it's boiling.
There's a slight amount of steam, of course, when you're boiling it. Depends on the temperature in the room, obviously, in the air or whatever. But
do it and ask my physicist husband.
Yeah, but fair enough.
But
what happens is when it's boiling, the air is coming up to the surface and the air is mixing it all up so that you won't see the steam.
Gotcha, okay, because maybe the heat coming, wafting around the pot.
Right, you get convection at the top. But if you then turn it off, then all you're going to see is the steam.
But I think steam comes out of my teapot when the water is boiling.
Of course.
Yes.
Of course. The trick is if you have an open pot, it'll tend to mix up with the air around it.
Ah.
Makes perfect sense.
That might be a good answer.
David, thanks for the call. And the number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Artie in Housatonic, Mass. Artie, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I was thrilled to hear you have an ice expert. I have another ice question.
Internationally renowned ice expert.
Oh, good, yeah. Good. This is about icicles, actually. It's a little early in the winter. We don't have a lot of them now, but when you have a heavy snow and a blizzard or something, you get these massive icicles, heat loss through the roof and, melts the water. But the phenomena that I've noticed, and I don't think it's an optical illusion, although I've considered that, is a tendency for these really large ones to bend back toward the building. And you'd think that with, gravity being as straightforward as it is, you'd have a nice, plumb, straight icicle. And I've been curious how to explain that. Like I say, I don't think it's an illusion. I think it really happens. So any thoughts on what, I thought maybe the water was running down the backside of the icicles as it came off and it built in. But anyway, I'd be interested in anything you had.
I've seen that as well, and quite often. I've always thought it was a phenomenon of the air moving down the side of the building because the building is warm, and the air outside, away from the icicle on the other side of it, is colder. And so what happens is it'll tend to freeze on one side more than the other. You'll get an air rush as a result. I can tell you that if you go to the caves around here, just as an example, you get icicles are actually forming. The icicle water hitting the bottom forms these mounds of ice that get quite long off the top of the cave. And because the cave breathes a bit, sometimes they're to the inside of the cave, sometimes to the outside of the cave. So you get these very, very strange structures, and they're all exactly the same. So you may get 25 of these mounds, and they're all exactly the same shape. So my guess, it has something to do with the air running down the side of the building because of heat loss, but I'll check into that as well.
Fair enough. Artie, thanks a lot. We have to take a break here. Ed Stander and Nancy Slack are the Science Forum panelists today, and we'll be back in a moment.
WAMC comes from the Honest Weight Food Co-op, located at 100 Waterleet Ave in Albany. Offering local and organic produce, groceries, specialty foods, and more, honestweight.coop. Lori Ilvesacker, Coldwell Banker Village Green Realty, Woodstock. A professional realtor with 30 years of experience specializing in the greater Woodstock area, home market, and in finding acreage for building new. 845-901-6129. And Harvest Spirits Farm Distillery, Route 9, Volation, New York. Core Vodka and Cornelius Applejack available at the distillery. Open weekends for tours, tastings, and sales. HarvestSpirits.com.
Welcome back to Vox Pop on WAMC. It's the Science Forum. Ed Stander's here. Nancy Slack is here. And Ray Graff, I'm your host.
You're there, too.
I'm here, but I'm not part of the panel. All right, here's one from email. Question for the science panel.
That's us.
We've ascertained that. Right. Why is it that earthquakes happen so suddenly and without warning? And why do they not last very long? They only seem to last for a few minutes. Thanks, Mark.
Well, Mark, when earthquake occurs, it's because stresses have built up in the ground underneath and the rocks have cracked. And what you're hearing and feeling is the rocks actually moving. And when you get a crack forming, when you get a sudden break of the rocks, it doesn't last very long. It lasts for a couple seconds, perhaps, and then the earth roils as a result of that, and it's over. So that's basically what it's all about.
They can vary in duration, though, can't they?
Now, what about the warnings?
Okay, very rarely does it last very long. It may last for a couple of seconds to up to half a minute, but very rarely more.
But there
than
are
that.
Aftershocks, yes?
There are aftershocks, but again, those are rocks which originally didn't have enough pressure on them to break, which suddenly have more pressure on them because one part of it is already broken.
Right.
So that's what happens. So you get pre-shocks, which can happen because the rock is about to break, and it breaks locally, and then finally it fails catastrophically. And then you have the aftershocks, which occur when the rocks nearby break because the pressure suddenly put on them that used to be on the other rocks.
And the idea of warning is one that scientists have been working on for a long, long time.
Yeah, you look at motions, you look at what are called, you look at areas where the rock is not moving compared to where it is moving, for example, on the San Andreas Fault. You can look for things like that. You can look for changes in height of the land from satellite now. So there are a number of ways of doing this, but generally speaking, especially in New York, the faults are far enough underground and there's enough glacial crap above that you don't know what's going to happen until it does.
Mm-hmm. All right. Back to the phones we go, and it looks like it's Jerry in Schenectady's turn. Jerry, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon.
Congratulations on the casino.
Uh-oh.
Oh, did we get it? I didn't realize.
That's the word, yes.
No kidding. Yep. Interesting. Very good. Thank
you. Just came down.
Wow.
All right, go ahead.
All right. Well, this question isn't necessarily that refined yet, but I was wondering, I've heard that there's about 6,000 or 7,000 domestic flights per day in the United States. And it led me to think, I wonder how much fuel used to in one transcontinental flight across the United States, how many pounds of plastic could that have made, I thought. Which leads me to the question, do you have any kind of approximate conversion equivalents for the uses of oil for its common different purposes of transportation, heating, and manufacturing?
Good questions.
I don't have the second part. That's Ken Wells, who, again, is sitting in his bathtub somewhere with a bad back.
A great deal of it is used for planes.
Say it again, Nancy?
I think a great deal of it is used for flights.
Taking off on a 747 requires about 40,000 gallons of fuel.
Just for takeoff?
Just for takeoff and landing. When you're up at cruising altitude, it takes very, very little because it's just keeping it in place. But as it's going up and going down, it takes a huge amount of fuel. It's really quite depressing. If you do some of these analyses of, for example, if you're trying to see how many Earths it would take to keep all Americans alive, if everybody lived the same way as Americans, how many Earths would we have in terms of natural resources?
And you
can do these analyses. And I have a friend who drives a Prius, and he does everything absolutely wonderful, but he flies 3 times a year. And as a result, if everyone lived the way he did, it would take 7 Earths of materials, just because airline traffic requires so much energy. As far as the amount of plastic, I don't know the conversion factor, I'm afraid, and I'd have to look that up.
But great questions.
Yes, and thank you. I was wondering, can plastic be made with any kind of oil substitute, or if we run out of oil, is plastic not going to be around anymore? We're not going to be able to manufacture.
Oh, we can hope. It's a polymer, so anything that will polymerize will produce plastic. The world's first plastics, if you don't know it, were actually made in Albany, New York.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
The Albany Billiard Ball Factory.
They tore it down to make a strip mall.
That's right. It was a contest to produce a replacement for billiard balls, and that's where cellulose was developed.
And they found out that they exploded.
Yes, it was a beautiful thing when you hit them right.
When
just
was
the right
that,
way.
More or less?
That was in the early 1900s, late 1800s, early 1900s.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it stood for a long time. I think about 20 years ago they tore it down. Hey, Jerry, thanks a lot for the call, and let's go to Linda in Dalton, Massachusetts. Linda.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, how come flu originates in Asia and arrives here later?
I want to know that, too.
That was my question
good.
As well.
I didn't want to feel alone with
Why
that. And I just wanted to comment real quickly that my husband and I both saw a mountain lion on our property in Massachusetts.
Aha!
Did you
Definitely
take a picture,
a
though?
Lion.
No picture?
I'm sorry?
You didn't take a picture?
Oh, God. You would think that we'd have our cameras ready every minute, but
well,
no.
Know, mine is ready more often now than usual since it's on my cell phone.
How long ago was this, Linda?
This was 10 years ago.
Okay.
Well, look out for another one. I want someone to get a picture.
Cause
I
Me
think
too.
I think they're there, too.
Me
if you
too.
Find,
but
you
about the flu.
Yes.
Well, bubonic plague originated in the Yunnan province of China. Now, that had to do more or less with the rats than with anything else. That is not true, you know, for flu. And I don't know why that is, but I will take that for homework and see if anybody does know.
Great. I'm glad I stumped you, and I look forward to hearing you in the future.
When Nancy said it, immediately all I thought, I've been to China several times, and I can tell you that if someone has the flu in China, everyone gets the flu in China. There are so many people in such a small area, and everybody I was on buses that would hold 60 people, but actually held 300.
Yeah.
So maybe the answer to that is it doesn't happen first in China, but enough people get it in China so that they think it's really going to be a major epidemic.
That would be my guess.
That's a good idea. I'll have to see if I can find out more about it.
Linda, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Bye now. 1-800-348-2551. J.D. in Springfield, Massachusetts. J.D.
Hi there. I'm so happy. I love your science program.
Thank you.
Two things. One about the boiling water. My grandmother, when making tea, said she just couldn't stand tea that was off the boil. Apparently, it raises all kinds of ruckus, makes all kinds of noise. But when it actually begins to really be boiling, it makes little noise at all. And I just thought that was a phenomenon that I also watched in my life. The other thing I had about the cough on the airplane with the Ebola spreading, does that minimal amount have maybe immunological aspects to it if you get such a small exposure, if there indeed is one?
Oh, that's a good question.
That might be true, because one of the things that happens with Ebola is that the immune systems of the people that get it are inactivated, and it's not entirely clear exactly how that works. So that is possible, but I think you needn't worry about flying. That's my bottom line.
Well, my thing
other things.
If you don't worry about stuff, you're probably going to be happier and live longer.
And if you're happier and live longer, you're less likely to get sick.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah. I like that. Thank you for that confirmation.
Thanks, J.D.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye.
Enjoy the program.
So, Nancy, explain for us briefly and simply the immunization process. So when you are immunized, you get a very small amount of whatever it is they're immunizing you against?
Well, that's actually what they're trying to do before they actually get a vaccine for Ebola. And they've been doing that. It's not clear from what I've read how successful that's been.
I mean, how do you test it?
They've been using blood of people who had survived Ebola, you know, so for antibodies to insert them in someone else. But and some of those people have indeed recovered, but then other people recover without doing that. So I think, and one person they did that for fairly recently died. So,
but that's for a cure. I'm talking about immunizing against.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's one way of immunizing people against a disease, by providing the person with antibodies. You know, that's how if you had measles when you were a child,
yeah,
you have antibodies against the measles virus. And you're very unlikely to get measles again. So that works naturally for all of us who still had childhood diseases. They're going away now since we seem to get vaccines for most of them.
Well, something that can kill you, like Ebola, if they test an immunization for that, then what do they do? Put you in with someone who has Ebola and hope you don't get it? How do they test it?
Well, actually, Pasteur did that, of course, with the rabies. And it worked, thank goodness, but nobody could do that anymore. They try to test it on animals first, and we have chimpanzees and various monkeys get Ebola, so that probably is where the testing would occur.
Okay.
It is really, I think, a shame that this disease, which has such a high fatality rate, that no company or no country was willing to fund the making of a vaccine for Ebola until this major epidemic occurred. It's apparently not as difficult to do that as to make one for HIV, for example. And there is one now they're testing, and I think soon there probably will be one they're using. But still, so many people have died.
Yeah. Let's go to Carol in Saratoga. Carol, you're on.
Hi, very much. I have a comment about the boiling water.
Okay.
Ann and I are going to be boiling a lot of water tonight.
I know. I was always under the impression, and I'm not an expert, but that when the heat is under the water, the heat of the water gets to 212, very hot. So that is also, and the water turns to steam, which is why when you're boiling water in a pan, you don't see anything until, right above the water. You see the steam further up. Because it's still in the gaseous state close to the surface of the water, as it cools down, it condenses, and that's when you see the steam. Same reason why when you turn the fire off under the pot, the water immediately is now less than 212, or not, immediately, which is why now you see more steam than when you had the fire under it, because the vaporized water is condensing, and that's why you see it. That was my impression.
That's good. I like that. And the way to test it would be to try it in a dry room where there isn't a lot of water in the atmosphere to see whether it does condense, and as a result, you get the steam or you don't get the steam. But that makes perfect sense, except that if it's boiling away, the water is at 212, and you should be seeing steam even as it's boiling rather than only after it stops. And that's really the question the other person had, is why do you only see the steam once it stops?
Once it stops. I'm going to boil some water, and if my husband can't help, I'm going to call Ken Wells, who is home with a bad back.
Fair enough. Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Bye now. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to another Carol, this one in Southern Washington County. Hi, Carol, you're on.
Yes, I'm here, and I'm very glad you have your program. I wanted to confirm that New York State, at least from our eyes, three of us, does have a mountain lion. And where I live along the Hudson River, I've spotted bobcat many times. But my daughter and son-in-law are in central Washington County, and this spring we had dispatched raccoons that had been taking out chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And when we went to gather up remains and dispose of them, on the other side of the chicken coop definitely was a mountain lion. And it was gone in a flash, but the long tail was there, and a very broad, large head. Its head was at waist height, so it was a large animal, and no mistaking it to any of us.
Well, you know, I have a friend at UMass who is a mammal expert. I'm going to get in touch with him and see what he's heard about them lately.
Now, what I wanted to say in regard to the put it on YouTube, you know,
yeah.
Get the pictures, advertise it. No.
Why?
And the reason being that there are a lot of hunters who would consider that an A1 kind of trophy, and they would never tell anybody.
Absolutely.
And we do not want that to happen. We have a big enough problem as it is with deer poaching.
When people also might panic about their children in the woods.
Yeah, and when this land was purchased, before deer season, we had 4 deer poached, only the haunches taken, ATVs used, and being that there is a venison pantry and what we are also looking to do is making ourselves more sufficient off the land. To us, that was just unconscionable, this notion of trophy hunting.
Mm-hmm.
or to do it for no reason than sport. And that's how we feel there's too many people who would view mountain lion hunting in that regard.
All right.
So we don't let people know. And a cub was maybe three or four years ago, a cub was killed, and yes, again, it quickly disappeared, and no one said anything about it.
That is very interesting.
That is very interesting. I have not heard that before, but I'm going to check about this, too.
Carol, we got to run, but thank you.
Thank you.
Bye now.
I wonder about Sasquatches now.
You see? We'll do the Bigfoot show next time.
I think so.
Thank you for that. All right, let's quickly go to Mark in Poughkeepsie. Mark, you're on. We have about a minute.
Okay. Earlier, someone was asking about why new flu strains tend to come from China.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the first part of that is flu can mutate pretty fast, so actually a new strain could come from pretty much anywhere. But the reason we get the pandemic ones from that part of Asia is largely because you have an agriculture system with people and birds like ducks and hogs all living in close proximity to each other. And all of those things are alternative hosts for the flu.
Uh-huh.
So you can get the flus mixing genes so that a flu that can infect people will pick up a gene maybe from one that used to infect pigs or ducks. And now people aren't immune to that anymore, and that starts the pandemic usually.
Uh-huh.
Right. Yes, all of that is true. I wonder, though, aren't there other systems elsewhere in the world that could happen?
I think there are, but it doesn't seem that for whatever historical reason it hasn't. The pandemic ones haven't originated somewhere else.
Yeah, because bird flu, of course, is one that transfers to human, and that's been a big problem in the past. Thank you.
Sure,
Mark. Thanks a lot for the call, and that'll have to do it today. Interesting. Now, pretty evenly divided: Ebola and bobcats, and a little boiling water thrown in.
Nothing about fracking.
Incredible.
No questions about fracking.
Considering the news, and you'll hear that in a moment, the New York State powers that be saying no to fracking, and you'll hear that in a moment on the news. Nancy Slack, Ed Stander, that was a fun show. You did wonderful work. Thanks to everybody who listened and to those who called. Support comes from Audubon Service, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, offering service, repair, and diagnosis of imports, specializing in late model Volkswagen, Audi, and BMW. AudubonTechnic.com. And Stone Soup Concrete, specializing in handcrafted and environmentally sound concrete countertops, sinks, furniture, and floors, serving the Northeast since 2001. StoneSoupConcrete.com. And on Facebook. Thanks again for listening and for calling. Zach Malloy was the engineer. Our phones were answered by Bruce Herbach, our producer Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we welcome our old buddy Gordon Fricke, and we'll talk about cars and motors and trucks and take your calls as well. Stay tuned now for a news update.